Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, September 19th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Albany Med Health System, four hospitals, a medical college, and a children's hospital. The Albany Med Health System's albanymed.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. If you have a question about anything gastroenterology related, if you want to hear her new slogan, which we will be releasing in a few minutes, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's a doozy. This is definitely bumper sticker material. You can also email us voxpop@wamc.org, but call us if you will, 800-348-2551. We'll be back after the news. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is gastroenterologist Dr. Jennifer Northrup. Board certified in gastroenterology, Dr. Northrup is a member of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, the American College of Gastroenterology, and the American Gastroenterological Association. Dr. Northrup practices all aspects of general gastroenterology and has an interest in functional gastrointestinal disorders, colorectal cancer, and wireless small bowel capsule endoscopy, and has been a member of the Albany Gastroenterology Consultants team since 2013. If you have a question today, feel free to give us a call, 800-348-2551. The phones are working, my computer's not, but everything's going to be fine. So call 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. That seems to be working well. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Jennifer Northrup, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Ray.
Oh, it's great
to be here.
It's great to have you here. And the summer went well? You look rested?
It did. It went well. Too fast, as always.
When you're a big-time, big-shot doctor like yourself, how many hours a week do you work?
Well, I am fortunate enough to work part-time.
Oh.
So I probably work about 25 hours.
That is amazing. Good for you.
Yeah, thank you.
You got a new slogan. It blew me away. Let's hear about it.
So Albany Gastroenterology has come up with a new slogan to bring to everyone's mind that the age for screening for colon cancer has been changed from 50 to 45. And the slogan is, 45's the new 50.
I like it. Now, but why was it changed and by whom?
So we were seeing a lot of younger people being diagnosed with colon cancer, and we felt that starting to screen at age 50 was missing a lot of these cancers. And so through numerous studies over several years, the big three GI societies decided to drop down the screening interval at age 45. So that means for screening that you are having no symptoms, no family history of colon cancer or colon polyps, literally you're asymptomatic, just needing to come in and get checked, that's 45. You may need to get screened earlier if you have other conditions, diseases, pertinent family history, but if you don't have any of those things, 45 is the time you start.
Interesting. So 45 is the new 50.
That's
and
right.
The three big GI groups agreed on this.
Mm-hmm.
Do we worry about what the feds say, or do they weigh in on this at all?
They took a bit to come around, although as of now, I believe that all of our big insurance payers are covering that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tad invasive, let's put it right out there. But are these tests that are also equally disgusting, where you send in your own sample, are they getting better as far as predictive or showing that, yeah, you got something going on here?
Yeah, I believe you're referencing the Cologuard, which is the at-home kit.
Right.
Where you take a smear of stool, put it on the card, and send it in. It's pretty good. It's greater than 90%. However, colonoscopy is still about 4% better than that, and colonoscopy remains the gold standard. The other thing that we're not quite sure yet is how often do people need to have the Cologuard?
Yeah.
Right now, we're saying every 3 years. But again, who knows? We're not sure how that could be. Whereas the timing for colonoscopy is, you know, we've referenced that quite well over many decades. So
okay, now that's great. We're starting earlier, but assuming yours comes up clean, how often do you have to go?
If your colonoscopy is clean and there's no family history of polyps or colon cancer, then every 10 years.
10 years seems like a long time.
It does.
Here's why I say that. You've bumped up or you've taken down the number from 50 to 45.
Right.
That's a five-year jump. But then if you're clean at 45, you can wait until 10 more years
55.
After that.
Correct.
That seems odd.
Well, I think we're trying to capture those people that start making polyps at a younger age. And if we check you at that younger age and you haven't yet made a polyp, then the whole concept that's been in place for a while of it takes 10 years to have a polyp turn into colon cancer still exists. Again, there are exceptions to that rule, but that we haven't found a need to change as of yet.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we got this email from Marion. I was just diagnosed with a hiatal hernia, 7 centimeters in size. Is this considered high risk for a need of surgery? Is there anything I can do to keep it at bay, prevent issues down the road? And that's from Marion.
Thank you, Marion, for your question. Let me just define what a hiatal hernia is for the listeners that may not know. Hiatal hernia is where a part of the stomach can kind of pouch above the diaphragm and enter into the bottom of the esophageal space. That in itself is nothing necessarily dangerous, but it can make certain conditions such as GERD or gastroesophageal reflux disease more prevalent. So typically when a hiatal hernia is small or asymptomatic, we really just focus on controlling the symptoms of reflux optimally. Now, 7 centimeters is on the larger side. And as to whether or not you're a candidate for surgery really would depend on, you know, different types of imaging testing, endoscopy testing that you've had. So that would be something that I would talk about with your gastroenterologist. But the best thing you can do is to keep any reflux symptoms that you have at bay.
Hiatal hernia, that's a common occurrence with babies, right?
Not necessarily. This, you can see it in children, but, you know, I practice adult gastroenterology, and when we see it is really just because, like every other muscle, as we age, it gets a little weaker, diaphragm gets a little bit weaker, and you can have that pouching up over the stomach, just kind of an overall, weakening. But you can have a congenital hernia as well.
Can you do anything? You can surgically repair that, right?
Yes, you can.
Is it tough? Is it outpatient now, or is that a day-long, two-day stay, something like that?
You know, it depends on the patient, but most of the hiatal hernia repairs can be done laparoscopically, which cuts down on the time that you're in the hospital and also the recovery time. But again, you know, I've had some patients just require one night in the hospital. Some people require two, but it's a much less invasive surgery than it had been. Although, again, there are some patients who require a full open procedure.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and the number is 800-348-2551. If you have a gastroenterology question, the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And as you can see, Doc, we don't see on the screen what's happening, so we're going to spin the wheel and hope for the best. Let's go to Kathy in Cairo. Kathy, you're on.
Hi. This is Kathy. I live in Cairo, New York, as you just said.
Yes, hi.
I'm so pleased that you have a gastroenterologist today because I've been having a conversation with my son, who is 46. Because I had a family history, my maternal grandmother and my father both had colon cancer. My gastroenterologist told me I needed to start screening prior to the age of 50. So I did. I'm 72 now. So I mentioned this to my son, and he said, well, I'll look into it. But listening today, I hear it's 45 now. But is his risk higher because it's his maternal grandfather, or is it his maternal great-grandmother? Do both of them put him at higher risk?
Kathy, thank you so much for calling in. What a great mom you are to think about your son. So
thank you.
The fact that he does not have a first-degree relative, such as a parent or a sibling, who has had colon cancer or colon polyps, his risk is not significantly elevated above what we consider average. So he would really be considered average risk screening. But at 46, he is due.
Have you heard, right. the, have
okay.
you heard the slogan?
45 is the new 50.
Hear the slogan. That's what made me call. I said, I can't wait till I get in my driveway so I can call.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, because my gastroenterologist had told me that having a maternal grandmother put me at higher risk than the fact that my dad, who would be a first degree relative, right?
Correct.
He said the maternal grandmother was more problematic.
Aren't they always?
Quite a while ago now, so maybe things have changed.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're okay and that you're prompting your son to get this important test done.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll take a break here. We're joined by Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday. We're joined by Dr. Jennifer Northrup today, and we talk gastroenterology on this edition of Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go to the lovely Northern Westchester region, Mount Kisco. Cookie, you're on. Hello, Cookie. It's not too good. Cookie. Okay, Cookie. Could give us another call. Let's go to Jay in the Berkshires. You're on.
Hi. I wanted to respond to the person who called in about hiatal hernia.
Yeah.
Because I've dealt with it a lot, and I was rather surprised by the gastroenterologist's answer.
Really?
And so what I will share with the listening audience is that I've dealt with this a lot. And it's really simple. It doesn't require surgery for me. It didn't. Any good chiropractor can simply reach up and pull the stomach down. It doesn't hurt. It's actually, a relief. It takes a few seconds, and it's done. And then what I learned from my nutritionist is eventually if you go on an alkaline diet, they stop. And so my chiropractor pulled it down, and the alkaline diet stopped it from coming back. And so I just wanted to share that alternate, that option, rather than surgery.
All right. Well, perfectly honest, the doctor looks a tad skeptical about that. Dr. Northrup, what do you say?
Well, none of these are evidence-based, and we practice evidence-based medicine. The other thing is hiatal hernia is dynamic, so the stomach can go down below the diaphragm, but nothing's going to keep it down there. So it can keep coming up and down.
So you can move it, but it may pop on back.
Absolutely. It's what we call a sliding hiatal hernia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for that one. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. It'd be nice to have his computer screen working. But you know what? Dr. Northrup, you're a trooper, and we'll just blaze on through the show. You'd be amazed at all the things that go wrong behind the scenes.
That's right.
The show is still mediocre.
That's right. No, wait.
All right, this email came in from Mary. Mary writes, I am an IBS patient with Crohn's evaluation pending due to repeat blockages and an SI stricture on imaging. You're going to have to tell me what all that means. Which tests are gold standard for Crohn's? They mentioned a camera pill or some other type scan. Just curious what the routine is. Thanks, by the way. My husband's mother died at 56 of colon cancer. After a late diagnosis, I requested his early colonoscopy screening at only 39, and he already had 3 large polyps, so I definitely encourage those earlier screenings. Okay, and that's from Mary somewhere in Massachusetts.
Hi, Mary. So Crohn's disease can be a difficult thing to diagnose. It is a type of an inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. There are many different pieces to the puzzle to diagnose Crohn's disease because it can exist anywhere in the GI tract from mouth to anus. So if you have Crohn's in the colon, that's Crohn's colitis. That's going to be diagnosed in a much different way than if you have Crohn's in the stomach or Crohn's in the small bowel. If they're talking to you about a capsule study, that means that they're probably entertaining something going on in the small intestine. But it can be diagnosed by a combination of imaging results, biopsy results, small bowel camera, lab testing.
Okay. This is, okay, so we'll go back to our phone lines here. 800-348-2551. I've officially attempted my last time on this. We're not going to get the screen to work. So we'll go over to the old-fashioned phone and Cookie. Are you there now? Oh, for Pete's sake. Cookie, you got to listen on the phone and not on your radio. We have to turn the radio down. Right about now, you're getting that signal. All right. For Pete's sake. Two strikes and you're out. Betty in Albany. Betty, you're on with Dr. Jennifer Northrup.
Yes, I'd like to talk a bit about the prep for a colonoscopy. I think it's Miralax and Ducalax.
That is one of the preps, yes.
Is there a substitute for the Ducalax? In the past, I had a reaction to it where I felt like I was going to pass out.
Yeah. Sometimes instead of the Ducalax, people can use magnesium citrate. We've used that before. Currently, though, we're experiencing a national shortage of magnesium citrate due to supply chain issues. So we have had to really kind of shift around our preps because of that. But I've had patients do more Miralax in lieu of Ducalax or Miralax in conjunction with magnesium citrate. There are also several prescription preps that we can give you so that you can avoid Miralax and Ducalax altogether.
How do the two medicines differ?
So Miralax is a laxative, osmotic laxative, where it pulls water into the colon and helps us excrete it out. And Ducalax is a stimulant laxative, so it causes a lot of cramping to help facilitate the bowel movements. Ducalax can cause a significant amount of discomfort where people kind of have a vagal episode, feel they're going to pass out, get very sweaty. It's not pleasant, but some people have really extreme reactions, and so we just eliminate it.
Okay. Betty, you want to follow up?
No, that's fine. I'm glad to hear there are substitutes. Sorry to hear that magnesium citrate is sort of on back order.
I know, as are we.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Why is it on supply chain issues? Does it come from afar? Is it coming from Asia?
I'm not exactly sure whether it's the components that they use to make it or, you know, even so far as the containers that they're packaged in. I'm not exactly sure what the holdup is, but it's something that we started to see in the beginning of the summer. And I remember answering questions about the prep for the fall saying, I'm sure we'll have it by the fall. And we don't.
That is very strange. Are there any other important medicines or medical devices that are lacking at this point because of supply chain
issues? Have been certain prescriptions for some of my patients have been backordered. So we have to find alternative prescriptions in the meantime. It's frustrating to say the least.
I bet it is. Yes. Dr. Jennifer Northrup is our guest today. Northrup, and I'll get it right. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Looks like Cookie in Mount Kisco is trying it again. We'll get to Cookie in a moment. Remember, Cookie, listen to the phone, turn the radio down, and we'll go back to you at some point here very soon. This email is from Randy in Glenville. I was recently diagnosed with esophageal dysmotility. Will you please give a brief description of this condition? What are some common causes? What are likely solutions for it?
So esophageal dysmotility is when the esophagus is not moving as appropriately as it normally should to move the food bolus down from your mouth after you swallow it into the stomach. There are a variety of neurologic conditions that can contribute to some dysmotility, sarcoidosis, Parkinson's, several other issues. But unfortunately, it is related to that four-letter word called age. Aging does contribute to a slowing of the esophageal motility. And so sometimes we don't know exactly what causes it. We don't have great medicines to really increase the motility of the esophagus. So we tend to work in conjunction with our speech therapy colleagues to facilitate different swallowing techniques that can help the food pass without too much issue.
Let's loop back for a minute. You talked about the new age for that first screening, and you said you have noticed the medical field has noticed younger and younger people getting these polyps. Do they have any guesses as to why? Is it just processed food? What are we talking about here?
So that's a great question, and I think that's something that's hotly debated. I think there's definitely some environmental triggers, probably a lot related to food and the way that food is processed. Genetic mutations also are happening. Why they're happening more, can't exactly say, but it's definitely a multifactorial combination. But we don't know exactly the reason for that yet.
I mean, are we seeing more genetic mutations across all medical professions here?
I would think that we are. And I think it's also that we're getting better at identifying them. So it might seem like, where are these all coming from? But I think we're just getting better at identifying them, and we're getting better at finding them earlier.
What percentage, roughly, of colon polyps are benign and require really not much of any work?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say because it really does depend on the patient. But the benign polyps are what we call hyperplastic polyps, meaning that, with some exceptions, most of them can just stay in the colon and never turn into cancer, versus the adenomas, of which there are a variety, that if they stay in, they can turn into cancer. So technically, when we remove those polyps, there's no cancer in them. They are quote-unquote benign. But I always like to clarify, those have precancerous potential. You know, sometimes someone will say to me, oh, I had a colonoscopy 7 years ago and I had polyps, but they were benign. Well, I really need to see that pathology report, because are they hyperplastic, which is benign with no premalignant potential, or were they adenomas, which are benign but have premalignant potential, and then you would have been due for follow-up in 5 years.
Now, are you able to see the difference, or do you need to biopsy that?
You have to remove them.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can get a look at a polyp and certain features about it, endoscopically, visually, the size can probably tell you this is probably an adenoma, but we cannot be 100% certain unless that polyp is removed and tested. So I always tell people after their scope, I saw some polyps, they were small, I can't tell you exactly what they were, but I will contact you when the pathology report comes back.
Very interesting. Dr. Jennifer Northrop joins us today on Medical Monday. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and the phone number is 800-348-2551. You mentioned the four-letter word age. I assume you have a silent H at the beginning of the way you do that. If we live long enough, will we all get some polyps?
Not necessarily.
Really? All right. So what percentage of us will get polyps at some time if we live to 70 or 75?
I think the majority.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phone lines. And Cookie in Mount Kisco is ready to roll. Zach, you got your fingers crossed? No, he's not. He's a definite pessimist. Let's go anyway to beautiful Mount Kisco. Cookie, you're on.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello. You're on.
Oh, my God. I don't know what happened. My phone kept going.
Oh, that's okay. I get that all the time. You're on.
I'm so excited that you're doing this. I am very, very old, and my mother died of something in her stomach, and I am hugely constipated. I don't know what I should be doing. I maybe need a nutritionist. I'm not sure. What advice can you give me? And thank you so much, Ray, for doing this.
Thank you so much. All right, doctor, what do you think?
Hi, Cookie. Well, have you talked to your any physician about your constipation?
I have, and they said see a gastroenterologist, and the wait list is 2 months.
Wow.
That's actually not a bad wait list, I have to say.
But, I mean, if you're constipated, 2 months is a pretty darn long time.
How long have you been constipated for?
Quite a while, and I've tried Metamucil and the other thing that's orange, or the white thing. And prunes I tried, and I just swing from then getting diarrhea to whatever. So is there any, what should I do? I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cookie, really the best thing is you really have to see a gastroenterologist, because there are so many things that could be at play, from other diseases that you have to medications that you take that could be contributing. I don't know your history as to whether or not you've had a colonoscopy. So the differential diagnosis is a big one, and really would be important for you to see a gastroenterologist and break all that down.
Now, if Cookie gets an appointment that's 2 months down the road, should Cookie go to her general practitioner and find out, hey, how do I manage these symptoms until then?
Sure, absolutely.
Cookie, you want to follow
up? Well, you know, I did do that, and is there a nutritionist you can recommend that I can do a virtual visit with until I get to see this?
Yeah, and we really can't do recommendations like that on the radio, but
you can check with your insurance company, and they should be able to give you a list of participating nutritionists with your plan, and you can contact and see if you can have a virtual visit.
Hey, Cookie, good luck. Thank you so much. We love Mount Kisco. We love that you call from there. Let's go now to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
I probably won't be able to answer this, but is there a connection between Crohn's disease and Alzheimer's?
Not that I'm aware of, Jim. What prompts you to ask that question?
Well, we just had our 60th class reunion. This girl that I knew from 1984 at least had Crohn's disease, but now they say she's can't even know what's going on from the Alzheimer's.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that about your friend. I don't think there's a correlation that I am aware of.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Got this email from Paula, who says, just a quick note from Casablanca to say how wonderful today's show is. Curious when the small bowel camera was invented. It's been prescribed twice to check on my usually non-symptomatic Crohn's. And that's from Paula, who lives around here, but is obviously far afield at the moment.
Oh, well, thank you, Paula. The small bowel capsule has probably been around for about 3 decades, and is really such an important tool for us, and something that I personally enjoy performing and reading, because it answers questions that we would not have been able to answer without it.
I mean, I know this is one of those things that you are really, it's one of your specialties.
Yes.
Again, tell us what it is. You take a pill, right? And it has a camera in it?
Correct. A small pill, it's about the size of a jelly bean, has a camera in it. Patient swallows it, and we hook up leads to the patient's chest, very similar to an EKG. And there's a battery pack that's clipped to the patient's waistband, and they go out. Everything's under the clothes. No one can see that you have it on. You have a normal day. And while you're out and about, that little pill is taking a multitude of pictures as it spins around through the small bowel. Battery life is 8 hours. So for most people, it will make it into the colon, and we will have captured all of the small intestine. At the end of the day, they come back to our office, drop everything off. That battery pack is downloaded, and we compress all those files into a video that I then watch. And I see the small intestine, which no one has seen before.
And so are you looking for things like the scaly cells that precede Barrett's and things like that, but further down?
Well, so right. So we start... You know, the beginning of the small intestine is the duodenum, so we have to pass the stomach. We do see the esophagus in the stomach, but once we pass the stomach, we start looking, do we see areas of bleeding, things that could cause bleeding? Because sometimes we have patients with unexplained iron deficiency anemia or GI bleeding. Endoscopy and colonoscopy have not yielded a source, and so we're looking for anything that could cause bleeding in the small intestine, small polyps, growths, tumors. For people that have Crohn's disease, signs of Crohn's disease, small ulcers, erosions, strictures, which is narrowing, we can identify a lot of different abnormalities. I've made numerous diagnoses of Crohn's disease as well as of certain malignancies.
Bleeding. This is interesting. Those of us from a certain generation have been taking low-dose aspirins forever.
Right. Yes.
Is there any way, aside from the small bowel capsule endoscopy or whatever you're doing there with a camera, which, by the way, must cost a fortune to flush down the toilet, but that's another story. Is there any way for a patient to know, hey, I might have some bleeding going on?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you just don't know.
Right. I mean, we can check the hemoglobin, the blood count, to see if it's lower than it should be, what we call anemia. We can also check your stool for blood, something called stool guaiac, where we give three cards, make sure. And if we see any occult blood, that will give us a sense that, hey, we need to look a little bit further.
Yeah. Let's go back to our phone lines with Dr. Jennifer Northrop today. 800-348-2551. We go to Greenfield, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about what happened to me at age 50 in my first colonoscopy. I had a polyp taken out, sent me home, and 2 days later, I bled out and nearly died and was 4 days in the ICU and several blood transfusions to keep me going. And I was furious both at the doctor and the hospital because there was nowhere in the protocol that said, if you feel nauseous, if you feel chilled, you know, if you're tired, you know, this is a symptom. I thought I was getting the flu in the middle of July, needing to wear a jacket, when I spent 2 days bleeding out internally. So okay. I just wanted to call, and I hope that, that you know, things have changed since then. You know, so every other colonoscopy, I went, you know, obviously elsewhere.
Okay.
But I just wanted to say that as something I think the listeners should think about and ask what symptom does it bleed out and, what, you know,
okay.
How likely is it?
All right. Well, Debbie, thank you for that. Let's see what the doctor has to say.
I'm sorry that happened to you, Debbie. Unfortunately, a post-polypectomy bleed is a known complication of colonoscopy. It can happen anywhere from 3 to 7%, and usually tends to occur. It can occur right after the procedure, but it can occur anywhere from 2 to 10 days after the procedure. I can't speak for, you know, the information that you were given, but for what we give our patients, that's delineated on the consent form that that's a known and potential complication. And we also provide post-procedure instructions with a list of symptoms that if the patient has those, we want to hear about them ASAP.
Mm. All right, well, let's take a break here. Dr. Jennifer Northrop joins us today. It's gastroenterology on the program. We'll be right back. Dixie Dregs here on a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Jennifer Northrop of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. Having fun so far, Doctor?
This is a great, great afternoon.
She said with a little smile. All right, let's go to, what's your name? I can't see it on the screen here. Hello? You're in Albany. Fima?
Hello?
Hello, yes, you're on.
Yes.
You're on. Go ahead.
Okay, great, thanks. So every night I take a drink of water mixed with magnesium powder, and the brand I use is called Calm. And then early the next morning I completely empty out. It's kind of like a mini colonoscopy prep, and I become dependent on it, and it works great. You know, once in the morning and I'm done, and I feel great. Am I doing any damage by doing this every night?
No, magnesium is a natural laxative, and it's something that we frequently prescribe to patients who do have constipation issues. So if that works well for you, by all means.
So even if it's completely watery, it's fine, no problems?
Well, you might try taking one every other night and seeing if that helps.
Uh-huh. Okay, as long as I'm not damaging my system in any way,
no.
That's fine.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Colony and Jennifer. You're on.
Hi. I am calling because one of my children was diagnosed with gastroparesis. They were 18. They're 19 now. They do not have diabetes. They do not have any pre-existing. This was an idiopathic onset right after they got COVID. And ever since, we've been having a lot of trouble because after they were diagnosed, they were given lots and lots of prescriptions, and they are continuously giving lots and lots of prescriptions. They are losing weight at a pretty rapid clip. They've lost 30 pounds in the last couple months. And we asked about a feeding tube because at this point they can't keep anything down. In fact, they're not even hungry because they're just not digesting. So I guess what we're looking at is we asked about a feeding tube, not the type with the stoma, but the type that goes directly through the esophagus, through the nose and down the throat. But the nurse practitioner we were working with, because we can't see the doctor until December, has said that that is a last resort, period. We're not even going to look at that. We're just going to keep throwing pharmaceuticals at it and seeing if they work. At this point, we're taking pharmaceuticals that aren't even approved by the FDA, that are brand new, and it makes them so sick. So I don't know why that would be a complete last resort when they can't eat and they can't keep food down. We discovered this by them not going to the bathroom for over a week, and it just led to lots and lots of testing and some other things. We spent a lot of time in the emergency room. But at this point, they just keep losing weight. So they just can't keep anything down. So we're just trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, idiopathic gastroparesis is a very challenging diagnosis. We have seen it after COVID. And, you know, the case sounds extremely complicated. And I really think you need to see the gastroenterologist because, you know, a feeding tube is certainly an option.
We have been attempting, but their doctor is not even available till December.
That
and
seems
so
about
we've
right,
just been
yeah.
seeing nurse practitioners. Yeah, and we've just been seeing nurse practitioners. And at this point, I'm like, by December, if they keep losing weight at this clip, they're 138 pounds right now at 5'4", so they're not in like a danger zone. But if they keep losing weight at this clip, by December, they'll be 108 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm terrified for them.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do because, again, they're just saying, you know, no, that's a last resort. No, we don't even look at that. We've talked about looking into a gastric pacemaker
mm-hmm.
because they're just like, at this point, they're taking so many pharmaceuticals, it's almost hard to keep up with how much they're taking.
Okay. Doc.
And it interacts with other medications that they're taking. So, yeah, so it's just could you tell me why those are last resorts?
That's a good question. Okay.
I mean, any, you know, invasive procedure is obviously not the first thing we start with. But if someone's not responding to kind of the first 10 things on the list, then by all means, it should be considered.
Thank you for that. Now, you mentioned this, and I assume this is anecdotal, but an increase in gastroparesis since the COVID pandemic?
Certain patients with COVID. Any viral infection can give a gastroparesis, which is a slow motility of the stomach, for reasons that are not entirely clear. Mm. So COVID being like any other virus, we have seen that happen.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. And this email, which I just saw... Ooh, I've lost it. No, I think this is it. This is from Ed. Can you please tell me if a capsule endoscopy might be indicated for someone with Barrett's esophagus with a genetic tendency to celiac disease? And this person, this Ed, is 23 years old.
So I'm not sure exactly what he's meaning by genetic predisposition, if there's perhaps a family member who has it, because we know first-degree family member increases the risk for celiac disease 20-fold, or whether you found a potential gene from, say, like a 23andMe package, because we've been seeing, you know, a lot of patients coming in with that question.
I'm sorry, what is 23andMe? I thought he was saying that I am 23 years old, that's what he had, 23andMe.
No, he's 23 years old, but the 23andMe is that at-home genetic test where you swab the inside of your mouth and you kind of see the nationalities, but you can also use it to identify certain genes you might be at risk for.
Understood.
So just because you have a gene that they have found in other patients with celiac disease does not mean that you have celiac disease. Celiac disease is diagnosed by antibodies in the blood, so blood testing, and the gold standard is doing an upper endoscopy with a duodenal biopsy. So that would be what I would recommend for you if you're concerned about that.
All right, one more email here, then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Anonymous. I'm interested in your thoughts about this, but I don't want to give my name on the air. It's rather awkward. My question is, what could cause a 75-year-old to have frequent bowel movements during the day? Almost every time I eat something in the first half of the day, this could occur up to 7 times a day, believe it or not. It has been like this for most of a year. Before the situation, I had more frequent bowel movements than most people, perhaps 2 or 3 times a day, for a decade at least. And that's from Anonymous.
Okay, Anonymous. Well, thank you for writing in. this is definitely something that you should see a gastroenterologist for, because this is what we consider, you know, change in bowel habits within the past year. The differential diagnosis is quite broad. Of course, malignancy is always a possibility, so we definitely would recommend a colonoscopy. We would also take biopsies during that colonoscopy because other inflammatory conditions, such as different types of colitis, could be present. There are other things that could be going on, gallbladder malfunction, pancreas misfunction, medications that you're taking. So the differential diagnosis is pretty broad, but this is something that we see a lot of. And please go see your gastroenterologist. We'll be able to help you with that.
We're joined by Dr. Jennifer Northrup. And back to the phones we go. And we go now to North Adams. Justin, you're on.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I am 34 years old. When I was 18, I had a lot of stomach issues. And given the fact that we have a long history of colon cancer in my family, my father almost lost the battle to it when I was pretty young. Grandmother had it on his side. I went in and got checked at the age of 18, and they did find what they told me at the time were precancerous polyps. They did remove them. I was never told to return for a checkup or to kind of see how things had transpired. Fast forward, I just moved from Oregon, so I'm recently relocated to Massachusetts. Went to see my doctor to see if it would be a good time to get a colonoscopy. She referred me to a gastroenterologist here in the Berkshires, and he said that he was not willing to do one for me until he saw my medical records. I had stated my family history, the fact that I had had a colonoscopy with precancerous polyps. In his view, he said that he was not comfortable doing a colonoscopy without having first seen those records. I'm a little bit stuck, though, because the gastroenterologist is no longer in practice, and I really don't know kind of what to do. And moreover, is it normal for a gastroenterologist to deny a patient a colonoscopy given their professed history with colon cancer?
Gosh, well, welcome to the area, first of all. And I'm so glad you called in because you definitely need a colonoscopy. You know, it is always ideal to get previous medical records. That is helpful. But I understand sometimes it's just not possible. Records are lost. They've been destroyed because if you're not supposed to save medical records for more than 7 years, or you're not mandated to. So sometimes those records just don't exist. And I think we have to have a trust with our patients to say, this is your medical history, and move forward with it.
All right. Thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. Catherine writes, I had a robotic large hiatal hernia 5 weeks ago. Any tips for getting through stomach dumping? What's stomach dumping? Do I want to know?
So a dumping syndrome is when the stomach empties very rapidly and all of the contents of the stomach kind of rush into the bloodstream at once, and people can get sweaty, dizzy, nauseated, headache. I'm not sure, you know, that would probably be a good question for the general surgeon. I'm not exactly sure that would be the person that, you know, repaired your large hernia. Obviously, you've got some altered anatomy in there. The best thing I would suggest is talk with your surgeon or gastroenterologist, because a lot of times they'll have a special diet that you can follow, or even a nutritionist can give you different tips about types of food to eat, timing of when to eat it, amounts to eat. But I hope that this will eventually resolve for you.
This email from Carla says, I'm 72, have had regular colonoscopies since age 40. My mother was diagnosed with colon cancer at age 45, died at age 46. My gynecologist once told me that she likely had a genetic disposition for the disease, and that if I'd inherited the gene, I also would have gotten ill at a young age. Is this true? And that's from Carla.
Hi, Carla. That's a great question. It's really impossible to know, because genes do mutate over time. And so some can become less concerning, some can become more concerning. So we really, it's impossible to answer, but I'm glad you've been getting checked regularly. That's very important.
All right. One more email, and then we will hit the phones again. This is interesting. This is from Shane. Subject heading, weight gain with a stomach bug. I've had some sort of stomach GI bug for the past 10 days. Despite my lack of appetite, emptying my bowels much more often than usual, I've gained about 10 pounds, from about 185 to 195, which is very unusual. Is it common for a stomach bug to make you gain weight? And that's from Sean in High Falls.
Well, it's unusual, but, you know, if you have some appetite and you are eating some foods, might they be high-calorie, non-nutritive foods? Because that's what you can tolerate, then you will gain weight. Could there be some water retention? These are all possibilities. It's unusual, but just something to keep an eye on.
Dr. Jennifer Northrop is our guest today, and Jessica's in Newburgh. Jessica, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. My son, who's 18 years of age, was diagnosed about 5 years ago with something called eosinophilic esophagitis. We did an elimination diet where he was a vegan who was gluten-free and soy-free, so it was pretty extreme. Really, nothing came back from his allergy testing. Nothing came back that was significant in terms of food allergies. His doctor really just said that he just needs to really limit his dairy. We recently moved, and we found when we moved, when we were getting ready to sell our home, that the kids' playroom actually had some mold in the wall. And I was just wondering if you had heard anything about a correlation between EOE and mold spores.
Wow, that's very interesting. I personally have not heard of a correlation with that, but that's not to say it can't exist.
Okay. So, all right. He's, you know, he's thriving. He's 18 years old. He's in college. I was just wondering because, you know, at 18, he doesn't really want to take his meds anymore. So, because he takes a slurry every night.
I understand. Yeah.
All right, Jessica. Well, good luck. Thanks for the call. Let's go over to Greenfield. And Jane, you're on.
Yes, I just after the discussion with the older lady who said she was so constipated, and it seems to have been a recent thing, I have always suffered from constipation, so I knew to take this, that, and the other thing. This became impossible, and I went to various doctors, and they kept prescribing, you know, the Metamucils, the laxatives, whatever. I went to a recommended doctor by somebody else. He listened to me, took one look, and said, can I take a blood test? And I said, of course. And he came back a little while later. Low thyroid.
Low thyroid.
Yes, that's very common. That's actually one of the major parts of a workup for constipation. So that's why I, you know, emphasized to the previous caller, it's very important that you see your doctor because there's a lot of issues that can be at play, and a thyroid workup is one of them.
I went to a lot of doctors.
Okay.
And nobody pointed to thyroid.
All right.
Until I got to the last one. Now, the other thing I do, and this is just what helps generally, I drink aloe juice.
Aloe juice. Okay. Hey, Jane, we're almost out of time here with the doc, but that was a good one. Thank you very much for the call. The number is, well, we're done pretty much. Dr. Jennifer Northrop, you made it through the technical issues, and we've done it yet again. You're so good at your job, and do you ever get tired of it?
No. I love, love, love what I do.
Really?
I do.
Okay.
I love what I do. I love my job.
I love that you're here and that you've helped us out again today, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Absolutely, Ray.
Support comes from Drs. Sarcino and McGuire Podiatrists, with offices in Greenwich, New York, and Bennington, Vermont. Surgery for the foot and ankle, nyfootsurge.com for more information. And once again, thanks to Dr. Jennifer Northrop of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants for joining us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the terrific calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz screened the calls. And well done, sir. Tomorrow on the program, we will do a small bowel capsule endoscopy of your computer with Tony Yang. He'll answer your computer questions tomorrow at 2. We'll see you for that.